It's Saturday morning. It's 10 o'clock. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
We are both here in the studio on this glorious Saturday morning, feeling a little relieved, personally, that not that Jacksonville didn't get some damage in this last storm, but it wasn't that many days ago when the cone was directed right square over us, and it kept drifting down to the south. And as it turned out, it went far enough west that we did have a pretty sizable flood at my house as the water overflowed the banks of the retention pond, but it didn't get up to and in the house, and it was a 24-hour cycle. You could watch it rise up, and by the next morning it was gone. It was very strange because we didn't get much rain. It was all pouring in from runoff, I guess. But, well, and as Adam said, a king tide.
King tides, yeah, because the extreme high tides, and it just so happened that that storm hit right when those were happening, and mm-hmm. It was a unfortunate timing.
And, of course, the winds coming in the same direction down the intercoastal and the river. So we obviously had some problems, but I sure feel badly about the people in Daytona Beach especially, and some of the people in St. Augustine and Volano Beach. There's a lot of damage down there.
I walked Jack's Beach yesterday about 4 miles, and definitely the dunes had eroded, but they all held. And so, yeah, there was no breaches that I could see.
Did the job, huh?
Yep.
Well, good, because they're very expensive.
But there are also some 6 to 8 foot drops to get down on the beach now. So it's definitely took some damage.
I remember, a little personal note here, we bought our house on the beach. That we've been out of there since the year 2000, so we've missed all this fun stuff. But we bought it in middle of 88 and closed by mail because we were still traveling from Wisconsin to come and see it. So sometime between when we closed the deal and when we got there, I think it might have been Thanksgiving breaks, would be right about this time of year, we went out and the house, you could walk out the back door and just keep walking down the sand and walk right into the water. Nothing. We came back and there was a sheer cliff that was 11 feet.
You know, remember, we had to put a ladder in.
Put a 10-foot ladder on it. You had to step up to get out. And I was standing there. We didn't know any of the neighbors or anything yet. I was standing there looking at it like, oh, my God. I just spent a fortune for nothing. And my next-door neighbor came out on his deck and yelled at me, don't worry about it. It happens all the time. It'll come back. And back it does. In those days, it did.
It still does.
Yeah, and it will. No, they've got a little extra help from the seawalls and stuff. But, man, being an oceanfront property owner these days isn't all that it was cracked up to be. We sure loved it, though. Those were the good days. Anyway, enough of that. Back to the program. I'd like to thank everybody, as usual, all of the regulars for always being here. You're the reason we do this, and we will be finishing our 8th year on the 1st of February and starting up year 9. It does not seem possible. And if you're new to the show, whether you found it by accident or if we told you about it or you have a friend or whatever, then try to stick around for the whole hour. But I promise you, you'll learn something of interest, if not usefulness or whatever. But we'll talk about everything in the world that we want to talk about, unless you pick up the phone and dial 904-222-8255, at which time we'll take your call and change the subject to whatever is on your mind. So we'll have a trivia question, too, right after the first break. And with all that said, this is one of those rare times when we're really, really excited to talk about the market, because
it's been an interesting month in November. All three indexes are now up 3.1% for the month, but they took very different roads to get there. At the end of last week, the Dow was down just 1% for the month, the S&P down 2.6%, and the NASDAQ was already down 4.7%. So in order to get back to positive 3.1%, the Dow rallied just over 1,000 points. The S&P saw an even bigger move, rallying 5.9% this week. And the NASDAQ had to rally a pretty whopping 8.1% this week to move back to 3.1% positive. So talk
for
about
the quarter,
some volatility.
Still bad for the year. But.
No, for the month.
For the month, yes.
Yeah, for the quarter, those numbers look way better even. For the quarter, the NASDAQ's up 7.1, the S&P up 11.4, and the Dow's up 17.5. Pretty incredible.
Nice.
Yeah, the year, though, doesn't look
as good. It's
going
to be tough to to break into green territory for the year.
Yeah, you but never know.
Never know. Who would have thought Thursday, too?
Yeah. The indexes weren't the only volatile area of the market this week. There was volatility everywhere, really. The 10-year Treasury yield, crypto prices, and the U.S. dollar all saw pretty extreme moves during the week. The 10-year yield opened the week above 4.2% and ended just over 3.8%. That's a pretty extreme drop. Bitcoin started the week over 20,000 and ended the week below 17,000, and it even briefly traded below 16,000. On Thursday, the U.S. dollar saw the ninth largest daily decline since 1980. What prompted all of that? It's hard to say exactly, but at least some of it came from a weaker-than-expected CPI report, which in this case was very good news. A weaker-than-expected report means that inflation was not as bad as forecasted. So it looks like inflation has peaked, which is something we've been saying for a couple of months now, and this report just kind of validated that. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. International stocks also saw strong gains, with the exception of Brazil. So apparently the market's not too fond of electing ex-con socialists to run a country, I guess.
Apparently not.
Yeah, strange, but true. However, Germany saw an increase of over 11% during the week, Italy over 9%, Hong Kong and Israel both over 8%. All of these countries are still negative on the year, and ironically, Brazil is the only one that's positive. Go figure.
Go figure, yep. I think there was a kind of a general consensus that Bolsonaro would be able to hang on down
there.
Yeah,
I think so.
And who knows how corrupt that country is, just out of control corruption-wise. And now the number one corruption person is going to run the show again.
It's crazy.
It's just beyond my comprehension.
With the 10-year,
it's like having a guy like John Fetterman be a U.S. senator. It's crazy.
With the 10-year yield moving down for the first time in a while, you might have guessed that bonds finally made some gains. The ETF AGG was up over 2% this week, while the long Treasury ETF TLT was up almost 4%. Even with that big move higher, it still trails the performance of the NASDAQ's QQQ ETF by 5% this year.
That's
so
awful.
It's crazy.
They're just not that volatile, what most people would say.
Well, when yields are swinging like they are recently, they are.
Yep.
The political makeup of Congress didn't change much with the midterm election, although we are still waiting on results from states that have either funky voting laws or are incompetent at counting votes, or both. It appears that Republicans will hold a slim majority in the House, which will curb spending for the next 2 years. Republicans pretty widely underperformed in this election, which was a surprise. However, a single-seat majority in the House is just about the same as a 20-seat majority in the House in these extremely partisan times. So it's unlikely that there would be much different if it was a big majority versus a small majority. If you can vote along party lines, still stops new crazy spending bills.
And do we ever need to do that?
Absolutely. Got a little bit more that we can wrap up after the break, but it was definitely an interesting week.
Yes, it was. Well, a quick note before we go to the break. Sarah and I celebrated our 50th wedding anniversary yesterday, and two of the three, the kids that were still healthy, because one of them isn't, came over, and we had a real nice time. You know, 50 years is a long time for anybody, and it just doesn't seem possible to me. Tom's been playing games in there. All right, we're going to take a break, pay some bills, and we'll come back and talk more about this wonderful week in the market. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we have a trivia question, as usual, brought to you by Ken Bales at First Coast Alarm. You can call Ken at 904-636-7888. Anybody who watches the market knows that this has been a really rugged year for the mega cap tech stocks. And one in particular that's had a rough time. Now, I'm asking this question as if it were the end of October, because the statistics are easier to do on that day. And we've had a couple good days that haven't bounced in here yet. But as of the end of the 10 months of this year, Tesla had lost $540 billion in market cap. My question, in the S&P 500, how many companies would disappear if they lost market cap of $540 billion? it's probably more than you'll think. That would take their net worth to zero or below. So anyway, back to fun stuff. Remind everybody, lines are open, 904-222-8255. But we don't want to stop talking about the market just yet because it was so much fun.
No doubt. There was another positive sign this week, and it was the performance of semiconductor stocks. On Thursday alone, the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index, SOX, was up over 10%. While most of the stocks in the index are still down sharply year-to-date, many people consider semiconductors the transports of the century and a leading indicator of where the market is going. So if we see a breakout in semiconductors, that could be a really positive sign for the next few months.
Didn't quite achieve their 200-day moving average yet, but if we had another couple of good days, it would, and I think that would change a lot of attitudes out there.
It would change mine, most likely.
And speaking of attitudes, the Bears are still 47%.
Yeah, and
that's a good thing, though. Don't take that as being a negative.
I mentioned the CPI report that sparked the big rally on Thursday, but the details of the report looked even better than the headline miss. Core CPI was also decelerating, and what is called super core, which strips out the pandemic categories, think of things like used autos and airline fares that have really just skyrocketed because either they couldn't get parts or the airlines furloughed all their pilots during the pandemic, couldn't get them back, couldn't find employees. So all these things that have gone up so dramatically in prices just because of the pandemic, that took a deep dive from 8% down to 4.3% inflation rate. So those are annualized numbers based on the month, but the last 2 months, but that's a big, big drop. So you're seeing trends. Well, you can't call 1 month a trend, but you're seeing the way that the reports are heading, and you can see it in the underlying graphs as well. So we've been saying for a while now, if you look at asking rents have been dropping pretty dramatically, and rent inflation, according to the CPI report, is still really hot, but it did come down from 10% to 7.2% annualized this past month. So now you're starting to see it in the CPI. But if you look at asking rents, they've been going down for 6 or 7 months now. So
they'd come down a lot trailing indicator. If interest rates were to fall, and that would put more people back in the home buying category. So they're having sort of an unusual demand holdover at this point. The trends are definitely the right way, unless you're a big landlord.
Yeah.
You probably like the old way better.
Yeah, it depends. I mean, the rents, the inflation is coming down. They're still dramatically above where they were last year, and I don't see the prices dropping too much.
Not in places where there's demand.
Right. In Jacksonville is what I'm thinking of. Yeah. You're still seeing now, if you're in a place that people are moving out of, sure, that can happen. Prices can go down. But I think that we're probably just looking at a new baseline now with rents being higher than where they were and not increasing at the rate that they have been.
Yeah, I was reading, I think it was the Babylon Bee, which, by the way, if you don't read, you should, if you are a fan of satire. Anyway, they said that the California bullet train is getting back on track and it's going to run directly to Texas.
Well, for what they spent on it, they could have run.
They could have run, exactly.
It's so funny. A lot of people don't remember that Governor, who's a senator now,
Scott.
Governor Scott, he actually turned down the bullet train because he knew it would be a financial debacle. And so California held up their hands and said, we'll take it.
And besides, who wants to go from outside Orlando to outside Tampa?
Right.
When you can just get in your car and drive it.
It made no sense. But go figure, it has turned into a financial debacle.
Oh, what a joke. Except nobody's laughing. And it was going nowhere also. Even on its best day, it was the worst idea in the world. Yeah, well, only government, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, this week, we'll have to see.
Yep, I'm not even going to venture a guess about what's going to happen this week. I have no idea.
Strangely enough, that was not the biggest weekly gain this year in the S&P or the NASDAQ.
No, I believe on the S&P it was only the third biggest weekly gain.
A third or fourth, I can't remember for sure. And then NASDAQ has had a couple other weeks that were bigger too. And this is within the downtrend. So the question on everybody's mind now, was this what they call a bear market bounce or rally? or dead cat bounce, or is something really going to happen? And we have long said that we think the election is going to really foretell what goes on. So maybe one day we'll find out what happened in the election.
Yeah, maybe. I disagree with you slightly there. I think the election will help. I was looking more for the inflation numbers to turn around, and I wouldn't call this report a turnaround, but it's certainly a step in the right direction. So as soon as we see the confirming numbers on the PCE report, then I think you could definitely see the market break up.
Yeah, that's the PCE's personal consumption expenditures, which is the measure of inflation that the Fed likes. They think it's more representative of what people actually spend money on. I wouldn't give you a nickel for anything they think anyway, but that's one they look at. So assuming it comes in and shows a steady contraction, then it will be good news. And we got to just get this over with and make sure that the House of Representatives, who controls the money in D.C., goes over the other way. Then we have the most glorious thing in the world, divided government.
Yep.
Where nothing gets done. And it's unlike life in general, where you might say, don't just sit there, do something. In D.C., it's don't just do something, sit there. I'd pay them all to go on vacation for two more years, and I'd be real happy. We'll see how it goes, but our attitude is decidedly better than it has been, although we're still very, very cautious. So we'll see what happens from here.
For sure. You want to talk a little bit about what happened in crypto this week?
Yeah, go ahead, actually.
Yeah.
How's your crypto, Sammy?
So I first want to say that we do not own any crypto. None of our clients may own it, but it is not under our management. If they do so, it's outside of our management, and they may have small accounts and trade in it, but we do not do anything personally with crypto. It was an interesting week in crypto, which had already, so Bitcoin, if you don't follow it, has run up as high as 60 something thousand per Bitcoin. It's recently traded in a range right around 20,000 for quite some time now. Well, this week, there was a little bit of drama as one of the largest crypto exchanges and its founder and CEO, his name is Sam Bankman-Fried. He was widely considered one of the gurus of crypto. And
he's been seen lately lurking around the White House and making all kinds of friends.
Yep.
Promises $1 billion to the Democrat Party for elections and so on.
Yep.
Oops.
Had a little bit of run on his.
I think he's got the runs right now.
Well, that too. There's a whole lot to the story, and it's very complicated. But essentially, they undercapitalized this crypto exchange. Customers started taking money out. They couldn't get it all out and deliver it, and basically the guy resigned. The company appears to be bankrupt, and crypto prices, that's I mentioned earlier, they went from 20,000 down to under 16,000 at one point this week, and all of that was directly related to this debacle that's going on with the company FTX and some of its subsidiaries as well. Really a pretty crazy story. He was a multi-billionaire a week ago.
In fact, I was joking with Adam on the IMs this morning and said, you know that millionaire series you could do? You want to do one in reverse?
I don't think that follows the American dream story that I've been talking about. But
well, it's funny, though, how many liberals hate this guy now. Because he only spent like $40 million so far, and they were expecting $1 billion over the next couple of years. So he's nobody now.
Oh, man. It's only in crypto and millennials. And the guy was like apparently living in a penthouse in the Bahamas with 10 of his employees and working 24/7 and sleeping at his office. And I mean, it's just such a millennial type story.
Isn't it, though? And you know what? I try very hard sometimes to be somewhat fair about things. I can't feel sorry for this guy.
No, I don't at all. I mean, I think everything that happened was probably directly related to him. And it sounds like he's very, very smart and quite accomplished in his short time. But he also got a little bit ahead of himself, apparently.
And you know who else is going to the cleaners on this one? You're going to love this if you haven't seen it so far. Larry Fink. Yeah, BlackRock had a huge investment with this guy.
Oh, no.
It's a time shame, isn't it?
Yeah.
I don't know. Are we getting bitter or something in our old age here? Is it just when people continually do things that aren't good for us? All right. Well, we got some new things to talk about after the break. And I think I'll just let everybody hold on and see. But we're following up on an inquiry from a friend of the show. So we'll pay some bills. Be right back. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And I remind everybody the lines are open, 904-222-8255. The trivia question's still out there. Up through the end of October, Tesla had lost $540 billion in market cap out of the S&P 500 index. How many companies would go out of business if they lost $540 billion in market cap, meaning they have less than that overall? It's just a whole number, and it's a pretty good size whole number. But Adam and I were just laughing a little bit because I pulled out an article this week that said, Joe Manchin wants a deal on Social Security, Medicare, and debt. Who?
I'm not familiar with that name.
I used to remember a guy with a name like that, but I seem to be in the mainstream of everything now that nobody, even in D.C., remembers who this guy is.
I really haven't heard his name since that whole Green New Deal, Build Back Better debacle.
How do you just throw away decades of political capital?
And it doesn't even seem like he's going to get what he wants.
No.
They're turning around. They're completely going.
You make a deal
back on their deal.
You make a deal with a snake, and you're going to get snake.
That's correct.
And tell me, Chuck Schumer doesn't qualify? So, well, we got a call coming in. So after that, I'll tell you what is going on here. First, though, we had a caller, or I had a listener email us this week with an idea. He said, why don't you do a weekly book report on money books? And we'll never get around to doing anything weekly exactly, but I think occasionally it's a really good idea. So we're picking up books that we have read and really suggest that other people read them too, because you'll learn so much about finance and money. So we'll do that when this call is done. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, gentlemen. Great show as always.
Thanks so much. We appreciate you listening.
Thank you. I was just going to take a quick shot at the trivia question.
Good.
I'm going to set the bar kind of high and say 490.
All right. You did. You set the bar kind of high. Yeah, I might say you're not as far off as you will probably find out by the end of the show, but it is a little bit too high.
Okay.
But we appreciate it. I'm glad to have the range narrowing now.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Keep up the good work.
Thanks so much. Bye.
Thank you, guys. Bye-bye.
Believe me, he's thinking right.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing to me how big. Apple's now worth $2.34 trillion. And that didn't count. I don't think it counted Friday even, where it went up again because it had another good day in the market. But Apple went up $191 billion in market cap on Thursday.
Pretty incredible.
It's just mind-boggling to me. I told Adam, Steve Jobs would be so proud. All right. A book that you've all heard me talk about, book that Adam's read, I've read twice, and it tells you things. I'll give you the whole story here. It tells you things that you need to know and will hate learning. And when I was reading it the last time, I would be sitting around at night with TV on, and I'd read a few pages, and it'd start to get redder and redder and angrier, and Sarah kept getting mad at me. Why do you read that stuff? And I could only go about 15 or 20 pages, and I'd learn something new that made me even angrier than I already had been. It's called The Creature from Jekyll Island, and it's about how the Federal Reserve came to be by G. Edward Griffin. It was written in 1994, and it describes a process that at the very best could be considered clandestine. There are a couple real salient features of this thing. It goes way, way back to the founding of the country itself. Thomas Jefferson warned everybody of the possibility that if we did a central bank, it would become tyranny on the people. He warned against the dangers of it, and he fought his arch enemy for a long time. His arch enemy was Hamilton, who wanted to create a central bank. But Jefferson kept winning out, and over the generations that followed, back in the turn of the century when it became in the 20th century, the most ardent supporters had not changed. They still wanted one. But the opposition, which was led at the time by John Jacob Astor, was very strong and very powerful. And then some stuff happened. John Jacob Astor was the wealthiest passenger on the Titanic, and he was not one of the survivors. So with their main opposition gone, the powers that be, some political, some banking, not all Americans, they started organizing a meeting, a very, very exclusive private meeting, which they chose Jekyll Island as the site to do their dirty business. And they put all of the employees on Jekyll Island, put them on vacation, fully paid, delivered them off the island, so on. They all had their own Pullman train cars, beautiful things. They all lined them up and took them down to Jekyll Island, where they had a lot of rules. And one of them was you couldn't use the last name of anybody there. You could only use first names. There were seven of these people, the main protagonists. And they started putting together a process of creating a central bank concept. But there are things that we don't know about a lot of things, but that's one of the big ones. One of the greatest controversies in the book is about the naming of what they were doing. They had to make it sound impressive so they could sell it to the public. The first word, federal, well, it is not federal. It is not part of our government. We don't own it. It is owned by several rich families throughout Europe and America. And they needed to not say that. So somebody came up with the term federal because it sounds, oh, my God, this is fantastic, and we'll all be safe and sound and wonderful. But then they had to sound like there was some security in it, and they came up with reserve. So they called it the Federal Reserve Bank, and it isn't, to put it mildly, it isn't. It is not part of government. We do not own it. We do not control it. A long time ago, when the charter actually happened, and the mission statement of the Federal Reserve said that among their duties were to maintain the economic system in the country so that we could approach full employment on a steady basis and keep the dollar strong. You won't find those words on the Federal Reserve website today. I was just there a couple hours ago looking. They have disappeared now. You find all about diversity and things like that on there, which you would certainly expect, but you will not find the things that matter. And if you can Google this one and you'll get various answers, but they'll all be within about a percent. Since 1913, in December, when the Federal Reserve was actually started, the value of the dollar has dropped by about 97%. Take a pause from here and go back to the phone. Good morning, Mark.
Hey, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I'll just take a guess at the trivia.
Great.
I'm going to just say, so high number, 465 companies.
465? You said? We're going to need something from you. Your name and address.
That?
So we can send you something. Because, yes.
Holy cow.
It's kind of strange because the answer is a range of 464 to 468 because a strange little thing goes on in there. Like Google has two listings, and there are a total of 504 stocks in the S&P 500 index. So I allowed that anybody could come in that range and polish it off. So you did it. You nailed it. And
thanks
I'm
so
proud
much.
Of you. Well, absolutely. I'll put you on hold, and Tom will get your name and address, and we'll send you something from Mr. Bales.
Fantastic.
Good.
Appreciate
Thanks.
It.
Thanks for the call. About that. That was all because we got the first one out. So got to thank Ron for giving us a hint in there. Anyway, I'll finish up a little bit more and tell you why you should read The Creature from Jekyll Island. There's one particular quote in there that I'm not going to tell you. I want the people who read it to see if they find it, the one thing that irritates them the most. If they find it, will they then call in the show and ask us what it is? So we'll see how that goes. This is going to be more fun than we thought. All right, we're going to pay a few more bills and come back for one more segment after the break. This is the Van Wee Financial Hour. Welcome back to the Van Wee Financial Hour. I'm Steve Van Wee.
And I'm Adam Van Wee.
And we have been talking about The Creature from Jekyll Island, one of the best books that has to do with money and finance that anybody has ever written, at least the ones in my very, very lengthy reading list. And I explained a little bit about it. There's one passage in there. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but it is the de facto purpose of the Fed. And if you decide to pick up this book and read it, I think you'll understand from what we've said so far why I find this book to be irritating, not the book itself, the contents, meaning the truth. The truth is very irritating. Now, it is, this is another little aside, I'll probably wind up with a tinfoil cap on my head by the time I get home. But anyway, I went in to Amazon, because I've got a hardcover book. For years, you couldn't get it on a Kindle. So I knew it was available a couple years ago when I looked on Kindle, and I went in a couple days before the election, and they had all kinds of hardcover copies, but the Kindle edition, the electronic version, was somehow just not available at this time, it said. And I thought, well, that's interesting. What did you do? Jeff, did you run out of digital copies? That seems a little unlikely. So the day after the election, I went back to Amazon, typed it in. Sure enough, it's right there. Gee, weren't we supposed to read this before the election? Like I said, I may wind up with the tinfoil cap on that one, but it just seemed really, really weird to me. Anyway, I can't recommend it highly enough. You'll understand things that you truly, truly need to know, and it'll irritate you when you know them. So I don't know if I'm unselling my own concept or not, but it's not what I mean. That's for certain. Okay. You had something you wanted to bring up, I think?
Well, I thought we could do a millionaire, but I'd rather wait on getting kind of late.
Yeah. So, okay, then I want to talk about another thing that's going on that's really going to pick your pocket. The powers that be in D.C. now have been on a tear about the energy markets. And you have been getting lied to in a manner that is just beyond comprehension. They say we're going to save money. Every one of us is going to save money by switching to wind and solar because they're cheaper to produce. If you would like to debunk that by reading the best article ever written on the subject, I have it for you. It's called The Real Cost of Wind and Solar, and it can be found on the website. You're going to love this one. What'supwiththat.com. No question mark implied. So if you go to whatsupwiththat.com and put in the real cost of wind and solar, it's not terribly long, it's not terribly short. It explains so much about why, actually about how they're lying, more than why they're lying. So when we hear that wind and solar are cheaper to generate than oil and gas-based electricity, there is, on its face, some truth to that. And here's the numbers. Oil and gas cost 3.45 cents per kilowatt hour. And solar is only 2.9, and wind is only 3.15. So they both are, on their face, cheaper to produce than oil and gas. But there's a little problem. Both of those have built-in downtime. You can't do solar when sun isn't out, like nighttime, and you can't do wind during a calm. So unless we basically sort of convert the core of the earth into a big battery and store it, that's not going to happen. So let's talk about just that part with the inefficiencies now. Well, all of a sudden, solar, remember now, oil and gas is 3.45 cents. Solar now costs $6.21. That's 114% more than their advertised cost. And it's 80% higher than oil and gas. Well, wind, through its inefficiencies, is 4.97 cents. That's an increase of 57.8 after what they tell us. And it's 44% higher than oil and gas. Now, let's get just a touch technical for a moment. When you have a solar panel, it's only at its peak production when the sun is directly overhead and hitting it right square on. Now, if you want to look at a good demonstration of what I mean here, just get a nice, powerful flashlight, point the beam straight down. You've got a nice little circle, and it's very intense. But now let's say you're searching for something that you dropped, and you move that flashlight up a little bit. The circle becomes more of an ellipse, gets bigger and broader, and it's nowhere near as intense on the light. The more you put it up there, the bigger the pattern is, and the intensity continues to decline. Well, from the moment of sunup, you get a very, very steep angle on your solar panel. Then as the sun goes through the sky, when it's directly overhead, you have a moment where it's absolutely running at peak efficiency. And then the sun starts to go over into the other part of its orbit and it starts going down and you lose efficiency. So it's like a big sine wave type graph of the efficiency of the thing. Also, we have seasons in this country. And in those seasons, you will find the sun either higher or lower in the sky. So if you really wanted to build an efficient solar panel, it would have to be, for those of you who are boaters, I would call it gimbaled, meaning it can move back and forth and up and down an angle if you want it to be efficient all the time. But, of course, the only way to do that is by putting a couple of electric motors on it, and then it generates electricity that goes to the electric motors, which cuts down the efficiency again. In other words, you can't win. You're either going to spend extra money and get very little, or you're going to spend less money and get very little, just the way it works. So when you hear all this about the latest word now, they're saying you'll save, every family will save a minimum of $500 a year, and they'll even help you with a tax credit for your new toaster or coffee maker, get an efficient one. And maybe that only makes your coffee lukewarm, I'm not sure. But whatever, that they'll give you tax credits for that, and you're supposed to readily accept this change. One of the other ones I read, a big exhaustive study, said everybody's going to save $1,800 a year. You're not. In fact, it's going to cost you at least that much and maybe more, and yet they keep pushing it. And we have got to stop this insanity that's going on. There's winter coming. I heard this morning on the news that the cost of heating oil in the Northeast now is up 68% this year. And there's a lot of people up there living on fixed incomes, and the 68% increase in their heating costs is not going to allow them to do the things like eat, stay warm, and all that stuff that we normally come to think of in a country this prosperous. So these people have got to be stopped, absolutely stopped. And Biden's over there right now, blundering his way through another meeting, talking about how much we're going to spend $11 billion a year so that other countries can get up to date on their wind and solar. It's beyond my comprehension. This stuff is going to hit your wallet. You are going to be worse off than you are unless we get this insanity stopped. So that may sound a bit political, but believe me, it's spoken right square from the wallet. It's going to hurt everybody. All right, enough of that. Let's see. Is there any good news? I always like to end with some good news if I can. There isn't much. Next week, we want to talk some more about reverse mortgages and some things about your upcoming tax changes. And one of the things that you're going to find is that inflation is really, really hard on your income tax bill. that's not good news either. So I'm having a little trouble finding any of that right now. Adam, you got anything upbeat to say? Let's go back to the market.
It was a great week in the market. Yeah.
See, we knew we could end it the right way. This week, if we could do it again, what would happen would be we'd get that magic cross where everything goes up over its 200-day moving average, and that signals the probable turnabout from the bear market that we've been in.
We are quite a ways away from that on some of the indexes, closer on others. I would expect that I don't think we'll test it this week. It's possible, but it would take another big move on top of an already big move, and that seems unlikely. But you just never know these days.
Unfortunately, in those prior weeks this year, three for the S&P and two for the NASDAQ, I think, they've resulted in lower lows and it kept sinking. Yeah. So,
I mean, nothing fundamentally has changed. That CPI report came out that showed some promise, but everything else is still exactly like it was the week before.
Yep. So don't get too optimistic. If you've got money sitting on the sidelines and you want to start inching your way back in, that's just fine. You want 10% at a time or something like that. If you want to talk it over, you can always reach us through the website, VanWeFinancial.com, or our office number, 904-685-1505, and we'd be happy to discuss any of this with anybody. But till next week, we'll see you right here at the same time. This is the VanWeFinancial Hour.